So sorry for beginning a bit too early. And my name is Hiromi Yamaoka from the Bank of Japan. Today, we'd like to have a discussion about the central bank and fintech. Indeed, fintech is a really important factor for the financial world. And there's a development in these 10 years. Just 10 years ago, a decade ago, we were central bankers were in the global financial crisis. But at that period, there's no blockchain, no DLT, no cryptocurrency, because Bitcoin was created in 2009, and blockchain DLT also were created in 2008 to 2009. And in terms of the smartphone and iPhone, for example, iPhone was introduced in 2007. So around 10 years ago, not so many people have an iPhone. But now, according to the World Bank statistics, there's still 1.7 billion unbanked adults. But among them, already 1.1 billion adults have a smartphone or mobile phones. So, and AI, of course, AI has existed since 1980s, but in terms of the machine learning or deep learning, those technology has developed very rapidly since around 2010. So in these 10 years, there's lots of technological progress in terms of information technology. And those technology enabled the financial industry to serve everyone in the world, globalization financial services. And at the same time, they can use the big data and customize the financial services to everyone in the world. For example, mobile phone or smartphone were originally the phone. So it's one person per one mobile phone. And for example, if you think about the PC, PC is one instrument per one family. But if we think about the financial services, by using a mobile phone, we need to think about the customized services to satisfy each person's needs. And the third one is the virtualization of financial services. For example, if we use cloud computing and the DLT blockchain and the mobile phone as a customer's relationship management, we can use a virtual bank. We can create a virtual bank without having any brick and mortar branches. So this is a big change in the financial world. And at the same time, central bank has many, many responsibility about the financial industry and financial services. Both central bank need to provide a safe and efficient infrastructure and maintain the stability of payment and settlement, maintain financial stability, conduct monetary policy, and facilitate the development of finance and industry. And there's lots of impact of fintech on the financial structure and the financial market. For example, there's lots of new entrants in financial services. For example, non-bank payment service providers, P2P lenders, without using their own balance sheet to provide loans and credit, and robo-advisors. And there's a new product, crypto asset, which is becoming a speculative investment tools. And new networks and conglomerates. Now, big techs are entering the financial services by using their own big data and utilize those data for a variety of businesses. And there's a new market strategies. There's lots of algorithm-based trading and high-frequency trading. And there's a new sources of systemic importance. The more and more financial institutions are using the cloud computing services. And more businesses are based on the big data. And new structure of finance. Actually, there are lots of decentralized technologies like a blockchain or DLT, and open banking by using open API. And in terms of the hard risk sharing structures, formally, banks have its own risks by providing loans and gathering a deposit, and they are making a maturity transformation by using their own balance sheet. But nowadays, for example, in terms of the robo-advisors, they do not use their own balance sheet in order to perform as a fund intermediary functions. So from the central banker's point of view, maybe the risk sharing structure is changing a lot due to the fintech developments. So now, today, we have excellent and fantastic panelists from all over the central banks. From APAC, Mr. Greg Johnston from Reserve Bank of Australia. As you know, Reserve Bank of Australia is a leading central bank in terms of promoting financial service, and Reserve Bank of Australia launched the FSS in order to support the 24/7 payment services on a private basis by offering the central bank money settlement on the real-time gross settlement basis. And from Europe, European Central Bank, Mr. Mark Beldjus, ECB is also a leading figure to promote financial innovation in fintech, and they will start TIPS also to support the 24/7 pan-European settlement or payment by offering the central bank money. And also, ECB is in charge of establishing T2S, a new securities platform. And from Federal Reserve Bank of New York, New York is always the center of the financial innovation. Mr. Lawrence Larry Sweet. And he's also a leading figure in the BIS-CBMI in terms of the cybersecurity and endpoint security. So first of all, I'd like to ask my central bank colleagues about the important elements of fintech for the central banks. For example, which technology are very important from the viewpoint of central banks, and which technology or which elements of fintech are you focusing on specifically? So first, I'd like to ask Greg about your opinions on that point, please.
Thank you very much, Hiromi. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon to talk about central banks and fintechs. I come from the financial infrastructure provision side of the Reserve Bank of Australia, so I run the area that operates our RTGS system, which is called RITS. And as Romy's pointed out, we have a new system that's now operating since October last year, and it was part of a public launch earlier this year called the Fast Settlement Service, and that's an integral part of the new payments platform. The RBA has a range of interests which relate to fintech. First of all, we have policy responsibilities, like many central banks, for the efficiency and the stability of the payment system. We run core financial market infrastructure like RITS and the FSS, and we also provide services to Australian government agencies. So we have an interest in fintech from three different perspectives. I think if you want to get the common denominator about what motivates us, the short answer is it's the public interest. And so we will view a fintech opportunity not so much from, although this is true too, just purely from an interest in the technology itself, but for us it's got to have a purpose and relate to one of our roles. So in terms of what can we do and what have we done, we obviously listen to our government clients. We listen to the fintech community through our policy area. We have got involved in the building, we hope, of infrastructure that will facilitate easier access by the fintech community to the Australian payment system. And that's through the new payments platform and the development of the FSS. We can promote a common vision of where we need to be as an industry. And sometimes when you need a multilateral uplifting capability, the central banks can add a lot of value there. We can promote common standards and a common experience for that fintechs can take advantage of. So it is not a great thing for fintechs if they're trying to build a product that they believe is useful for a customer segment. The experience that their customers will get from one, say, financial institution to another is quite different. We're interested as a market infrastructure operator in fintech that will help us make our system more stable. And that could mean AI to monitor transactions that we've got going through our system to detect anomalies. From a government agency point of view, we might be interested in fintech that presents or helps us present a more readable and digestible set of data that our customers are interested in. So we've got a range of irons in the fire. There's a lot going on, even for central banks in this space.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you. So next, Mark, which element are you interested in as a central banker, or what area are you focusing on as your responsibility in the element of fintech, please?
So thank you, Hiromi. Thank you to have invited us here today. I mean, we have a lot of interest on fintechs from different perspectives. I will not repeat what Greg just said. I think we have the same approach in the sense that we have different perspectives. We look at it from all the angles, but basically to focus on our main objective, we want the market infrastructure to be as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. So that it delivers the best service to the economy, so that it brings the payee to the payer the quicker and the safer as possible with full trust, or that it brings the issuer to the investor in the quickest way as well, in the most efficient way, and with a secure and balanced technology. So fintech are a bit disrupting the way we are working, but it's a long travel on digitalizing our financial market and flows. And it's just further improving the speed at which we look at it. So we look at it from our three main missions. The first one, as a potential operator of services, can we benefit from this technology? So we test the technology. We test this with our friends, in particular with Hiromi. We made a Stella project to test how we can do payment in an RTGS mode. We tested also how to do DVP settlement by synchronizing two different blockchain with a technology in between. And we made publication together, and we are very happy. We are working on Stella 3, so the next stage of reflection. And so it's very important for us when saying that when we develop services, we need to make sure that the technology we brought in is the best for our purpose. So somehow we are technology agnostic. We are ready to use different technologies, provided it delivers trust, safety, efficiency, and operational costs, which are as low as possible. It's also true that in a globalizing market, we need to find innovative solutions which necessitate to interlink different market infrastructure in different contexts. So also here, this new technology can help us. So the operator role is one way we are looking at it. In this respect, we developed a FinTech Lab within DCB, and we collaborate with all the Eurosystem central banks on how we can leverage as much as possible this technology. So far, the rather more standard technology centralized seems to be more efficient for the services we need. So we are using them for the moment. But being curious and looking at it is very important. The second role we have is to look more at it from a catalyst for change, or making sure that the integration of the way this technology could flow in our economy is integrated, does not recreate silos, does not recreate fragmentation of liquidity, fragmentation of services. So we are looking at it also in this context to make sure that there is an harmonized approach to it, a good interaction between the different actors. And in particular, in the field of payment, we have been quite active creating task forces with central banks, banks, market infrastructures, making publication on those topics and seeing how we could develop eventually use case which could help us to reduce our fragmentation in Europe, which is one of our challenges. So we are looking at how to implement in a more efficient way corporate action, for instance. We are looking at how eventually it can help in the shareholder transparency increase within our economic area. To mention just two, we look also whether it can help for task withholding collection. So many, many points. The last point is we look at it also from a safety point, and I guess Larry will develop even further on this point. We want to make sure that this technology does not create instability, does not create escape to our regulatory and oversight function. So we should make sure that the way we make sure that the trust remains in the system can be preserved independently of the technology which is being used. So we really look at it from many angles. All of the points which are on this list are relevant. It means new entrants. It means eventually new assets or crypto assets. It means new actors which we were not using before. It means also that we have to deal with higher speed, higher interconnectivity and interconnection between the actors. And therefore, we have to adapt the way we are developing services and looking at it in this regards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. So then, Larry, are you coming from the from New York, the center of the financial innovation? And so, which element of fintech or which the technology of fintech are you most interested in? And as a central bank, what are you focusing on? And which technology is most relevant for your function or for your central bank, please?
Thank you, Hiromi. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and good afternoon, everybody. I would say, just like all of my colleagues here, it's not surprising our starting point of interest reflects our role in the financial system, which is we care for the soundness of the banking system, mm-hmm. the safety and efficiency of the underlying payment clearing and settlement systems that support it, and ultimately the soundness of the overall financial system and the macroeconomy. So that really guides mm-hmm. Our interest in all of these developments, as well as other developments in the markets and in the real economy. We have to stay abreast of it. So I think our first way we approach it is to make sure we understand how technology is evolving, how the different actors in the financial system are using it, and make sure we understand it from those core responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And we do that, you know, we must do it both domestically and internationally. So I could just share a little bit as examples how we attempt to do that. So domestically in the US, the Fed is actively engaging with the market to understand, both from like a supervisory hat, how the institutions are using technology and bringing it into the services that they offer, how they manage their operations, et cetera. And we also work collectively in the financial system. How can we support innovations in developing, very concrete example, faster payments? That's a very big issue now. The Federal Reserve has been working with industry groups over the last couple of years. What should be our objectives and the way to create real-time payments on the retail side. And just a few weeks ago, the Federal Reserve put out a new sort of, we call it a Federal Register notice, basically a discussion paper to ask about what kind of new rails, settlement rails, could the Federal Reserve provide in order to support the market in delivering faster payments, particularly on a 24/7 basis. So we're very much engaging and working collaboratively with the industry from the perspective of the needs of our domestic financial system. Mm-hmm. Internationally, as I said, technology provides both opportunities and potential risks, and we need to leverage the opportunities and manage the risks well. Mm-hmm. And it's no surprise to everybody in the room, sort of two of the key risks that have emerged alongside of technology is cyber risk in general, as well as the risk of payments fraud related to the phrase we've been using this week, endpoint security, how all the different banks and other participants in the payment systems connect to the central market infrastructures or messaging networks like SWIFT. We've heard of like the SWIFT CSP. So we're also mindful that even as technology creates huge possibilities, we need to be very mindful of making sure that the associated risks are well managed and we're staying ahead of that. And we recognize that's not just a role for each of us individually as central banks, but as the financial system is global, we also have to coordinate globally in our approach for this. And so we work very much hand in glove together in providing, both in learning and being aware of these evolving risks and opportunities, but also providing guidance or requirements or align policy perspectives in how to handle the risks as well as support the innovations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So the next topic is what central bank can do through fintech to promote the efficiency while maintaining the stability of the financial system and the payment system. And central bank may have a bunch of variety of functions. First, central bank are working as operator of the financial market infrastructure. Central bank operate the RTGS, real-time gross settlement system, large value payment system, as well as security settlement systems. So central banks are in a position to provide central bank money, which is risk-free settlement tools, to stabilize the payment and settlement system. But at the same time, central bank must pay attention to strike appropriate balance between the private-based innovation and the public-based stability. And then central bank may work as an overseer of the market infrastructure. So in order to maintain the stability of the payment system and the financial market, central bank may work as an overseer or supervisor, or sometimes, in some cases, regulators, to stabilize the system as a whole. And then central bank may work as a catalyst of the variety of entities. For example, in terms of endpoint security, as Larry mentioned, that it's quite important to raise the bottom line of the securities level. Because in the securities issues, there's a strong network externality. And worst participant may decide the overall level of the securities. So it's quite important to involve a variety of entities and promote the securities among a variety of entities. So central bank may work also as a catalyst. So the next question is, what specifically can central bank do to enhance efficiency of the financial transaction, market transaction, and at the same time, how central bank can maintain the stability of overall payment system or settlement system and the financial stability. So the question, Greg, how do you think about the central bank role, specific role, to promote fintech, promote financial efficiency while maintaining stability, please?
Thanks, Romy. Perhaps I can draw upon some of our recent experience in the Australian payments industry. As you're now, I think, well aware, we've just gone through a process since about mid-2013 to bring to market a whole new infrastructure. And as part of that process, the central bank had a range of different roles. Our payments policy people started a conversation about what do we think the Australian payment system and financial markets need as a next generation infrastructure, and we sought comments from a wide variety of people. In fact, anyone who wished to could comment. We then distilled what we thought the vision was, and then threw the challenge to the industry, and to their credit, they came back with a proposal which included some innovation, and that innovation was the creation of what was called an overlay service, and I think that terminology is now well embedded, I think, in payment specialists around the world. But the idea of it is that it is sort of like an innovation sandbox that sits around a set of core financial or payment system rails. And so the idea was that we would work collaboratively together with the industry to develop this new infrastructure. The Reserve Bank of Australia's contribution, aside from starting the conversation in that way, was to think about how we might arrange settlement, which is a core central bank responsibility. As Hiromi's pointed out, we provide a risk-free asset which payment service providers use to extinguish liabilities between them. So the question for us was, what would be the most flexible and the most usable settlement arrangement for that ecosystem going forward? And we arrived at the view, which was a little bit different at the time, that an RTGS, a real-time gross settlement option, would be the best for this new ecosystem. And that was a little different because many smaller value systems still settled on a net deferred basis. The high value systems routinely settled on an RTGS basis. So it was a technical challenge for us, and it was a bit of a change of the routine. But nevertheless, we felt that RTGS provided the maximum amount of flexibility for people who wanted to put business cases on this new rail. And the reason I say that is because it extinguished interbank settlement risk, credit risk between payment service providers as an issue, as a challenge to deal with as people are putting forward new propositions on this set of rails. So that's an area where we got involved, and we stayed closely involved through the project with all of those three different roles that I mentioned earlier, as a supervisor, as a provider of financial market infrastructure, and also as a provider of government services to the Australian government. The thing we've done since then is to stay involved. We still retain our involvement in the NPP Australia Limited, both at the board level and on various committees, to try and promote the ongoing use of that infrastructure. A key focus for us, I guess, at the moment is to encourage the completion of the full rollout of the capability of this new system to all bank customers, but also to think about now another key challenge, I think, for us is to think about how to make it easy and clear for fintechs to play and to develop new services on that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you. Just same question to Mark. What central bank can central bank do to maintain stability while enhancing efficiency of the financial transaction, please?
Well, it's a permanent struggling. It's not only related to fintech. The point is that we have to make sure that our infrastructure, whether we are operator, whether we are overseer, are delivering the best to the economy, that we have the strongest possible way to go. In Europe, so we had a reflection already some years ago to define how we would modernize our market infrastructure and came with different projects which are being delivered now. So the first of which, as you mentioned in your introduction, Hiromi, is TIPS, our payment instant payment settlement function that we developed. But it is triggering a whole reflection behind, which has been done together with the market. So it's not only an answer of the central bank, it's an answer really of the market. It has been triggered by a political act, so we could say a catalyst function in this regard, by a committee on which you have all the market represented, both the supply and the demand side of the market, so the merchants, the, I would say, consumer association, but also the banks and the FMIs, and the central bank thinking on how we can enhance the way payments are flowing in Europe, and which came about by sponsoring the development of a scheme called SCT Inst, which is how you frame instant payment in Europe, and pushing the different providers to put in place solutions which allow, like in Australia, even though Europe being an association of countries, sometimes it's a bit more complex for us politically. We have other challenges than you, I guess. It does not say you know them. And this being said, now we are in place to come with this. How does it relate to fintech? Well, because all the services which are being developed need this efficient infrastructure. All the innovation flowing around, in particular, you mentioned the iPhone as one example, but all the mobiles that we have in hand and that the new generation, the millennials have in hand, are expecting real-time processing. When you buy something through this, you expect it now, and you will not understand that the payment takes a few more hours or eventually a day more, while this can be resolved instantly, technically. Therefore, we need to adapt our market infrastructure to the level where the economy is. One of the motivation where we moved on this is based on that. But it has forced us to think whether we can use this technology, as I was saying. So now we are not using it for the moment, but we believe that it creates the framework for this technology to develop and for fintech to develop services in a safe environment. And we will modernize more widely the way the banks will be able to access central bank money. So we will further enhance all our services, our RTGS. We will try to rationalize our operational context by putting together security settlement and large value payment on the same technology. So we can rationalize the access to our services in Europe in central bank money and allowing really to create a central liquidity management function in central bank money, which will be accessible for the bank, optimizing the way liquidity can be used, supporting again the development of innovation in the economy and not having to rely on systems, on frameworks, which are elsewhere, not located within our at least control, so that we can have the stability element that you were mentioning, Hiromi, at least under our oversight. So it's a very important balance you have to find, and also very important to see that all these projects have to be done in a coordinated manner, not only within Europe, but more globally. So it does not say that because we want to have a possibility to ensure stability, trust in our currency, that we should not collaborate outside. No, on the contrary, the collaboration is very important. As you know, and under your authority, the CPMI has created a working group looking, for instance, at the way we enhance our RTGS. And I think it's a very important undertaking so that we can coordinate the way we are implementing those new technologies, the way we are enhancing our services to support the development of those fintech services, which are important for developing our economies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Same question to Larry, please. How, what can central bank do to promote fintech, enhance efficiency while maintaining stability at the central bank, please?
Well, Hiromi, as you pointed out, we have lots of ways to influence. You have on the screen, I'm pointing down here, up here, our roles as operators, overseers, catalysts. And I would say, in general, we usually leverage all of these roles as we're moving forward. And I could just elaborate on two examples, one domestic, one international, to give an example. So domestically, as an overseer, as I mentioned very quickly, the Fed observed about 3 years ago the clear developing need and desire for faster retail payments, and you know, how is that going to happen in the U.S. in order to make our payment system overall safe and efficient and supportive of evolving needs. So that was, you know, sort of role taking stock of what gaps exist, what should we try to fill it. Then we used our role as catalyst, as I said, by assembling, pulling together key stakeholders from all relevant parts of the financial system to work together, agree to a set of criteria, objectives, a vision of where we want to go, and identify different models and try to come up with a view on how to move forward. And then as operator, we asked ourselves then what specific services we could provide as an operator of a financial system, of a payment system, in order to support those efforts. One is already a reality. We had introduced a new concept for us, something called a joint account, which allowed basically any set of depository institutions who can have an account at the Fed to basically establish a pot of money that they jointly own and allow that pot of money to be available to back 24/7 retail payments. And that's already gone live in the U.S., and that's moving forward. And as I said, we're out for comment now. What additional services might the Federal Reserve provide to help facilitate the expansion of such faster payments and make it more ubiquitous, reaching across all corners of the 50 states in the U.S.? So just showing how we try to use the three roles together. Mm-hmm. Likewise, internationally, following really the eye-opening event of the big fraud and hacking of the Central Bank of Bangladesh, we took stock as overseers. You know, what can we learn about the risks for the broader financial system overall, not just for the risk of any one user of a payment system from losing money, which is very important, but also does it have systemic implications for the broader financial system? And we certainly, as an overseer, took stock and saw that it does. We saw that there were a huge amount of gaps in the way people approached the topic in terms of both preventing, detecting, and responding. And then we developed collectively, all of us on the table here, a strategy which we are now out as catalysts trying to promote around the world to help strengthen endpoints and making the system as a whole stronger. And as we're taking that catalyst role very seriously, we're also looking what each of us could do as operators. And so for that, I could already talk about in Fedwire. We already launched the first set of tools that we could provide to all of the users of Fedwire to set parameters and controls to help them prevent and detect potentially fraudulent payment systems. We've gone out there to sort of take stock and strengthen our endpoint requirements as a user of the service, and are looking at, just like SWIFT is doing with the assurance program, you know, what kind of a process should we put in place as an operator to give confidence that users of the payment system are adhering to the requirements that they're supposed to meet. So these are just two examples domestically and internationally. How do we try to leverage all of these roles and have them work together to our common objective?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Yeah, indeed, Bangladesh hacking incident was a very shocking event for the central bankers. And since then, Larry is playing a leading role in the CPMI, BIS CPMI meeting. And then I'd like to ask a bit more specific question. There's a lots of possible issues from the viewpoint of first operators and also overseer, and then catalyst also. But in terms of operators, I think that the RBA, Australia's initiatives are very, very interesting and important. You launched the FSS to support the NPP private-based 24/7 payment by offering the central bank money to support those private-based initiatives. And actually, it's quite important that you try to, it seems to me that you try to strike appropriate balance between enhancing innovation, private-based innovation, for example, the mobile phone-based transfers, while maintaining the stability by using central bank money. So, Greg, could you kind of elaborate a little bit about your project in terms of the FSS and NPP and the thought of the RBA behind those projects, please? Hmm.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the development of the FSS was a collaborative effort between ourselves and the industry, and we saw that as a means of promoting collaboration and particularly innovation in the financial system, in the payment system in particular. For us, it presented quite a lot of challenges. It was not our current system, RITS, was certainly not able to operate at the pace that we felt was necessary for a new system that would serve the retail payments industry. So it was a significant undertaking for ourselves, and we had to build up a new infrastructure stack, both at our head office site and at a backup site. The new infrastructure works at 1,000 transactions per second. It works in a really very secure way. It works in a defined message format way with the NPP under a close orchestration. And so yeah, that was a large undertaking. But as a market operator, the key objective there is to promote innovation rather than to predict what particular innovations that we would like to see or that customers would like to use. So if you ask us what do we hope the side effects of the development of the FSS and the NPP are, I think we would like to see some more specialised service production by industry segments. So in the past, traditionally, we've had a defined range of payment instruments. Just about everybody offers them. They're offered in a very predictable way to customers. I think we're hoping now that we will be able to bring forward innovation with smaller subsets of financial institutions and fintechs working with them. That might be to present information in a more palatable or more digestible way to customers. It might be to coordinate the movement of assets with the movement of money, which obviously FSS plays a key role in. It might be to develop apps or central pieces of infrastructure, which means that individual bills around the financial system are not required anymore. You have a central piece of infrastructure that enables bringing forward new innovation to market more quickly. So we're sort of hoping that the pace can quicken up, the specialisation of certain products can be more clearly attached to the needs of particular customer segments. So for us as a market infrastructure operator, it was all about promoting that sort of culture and that sort of possibility for the Australian payment system. The other aspect of what we do as a market infrastructure operator is to make sure that our access arrangements are fit for purpose to promote that sort of an objective as well. And with that in mind, we don't just allow access to banks, or as we call them in Australia, authorised deposit-taking institutions. So providers of payment services to third parties can also apply for a settlement account at the Reserve Bank, and that enables them to participate as a more equal player in the various payment clearing streams in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. So, Mark, you will also introduce the tips to support 24/7 pan-European payment. And also, you have also project of T2S, which involves a very innovative idea of some sort of the efficient collateral management. So could you kindly elaborate a little bit about tips and T2S?
Yes. With the angle of fintech, I understand. So as I said, we are modernizing our market infrastructure services to be able to better service the economy. At large, and TIPS is a good example of that, and whether we can use as operator, as we are now on the operator side, this technology or not has been tested, in particular in the Stella project with you, And we concluded that at this stage, no, the, I would say, more centralized type of technology is better in many respects in this case, and would deliver a better service to the market. But it does not say that because at this occasion we are not using this technology, that it will not be the case in the future. Again, our starting point is the policy action we want to reach and not the technology we want to use. But it has triggered different questions, and the questions are not only triggered by the development of services we do, but also by the evolution of our society. In particular, the way we give access to our services is also another question which is being discussed in the central bank community. In Europe, and not only in Europe, in many countries today, as new RTGS generation are coming, whether the current access policies that we have should be or not extended to new actors, which are very active in the field of payment, in particular third-party provider for services in this field, whether it's better that they stay out or in, or whether we should bring them in partially for some activity or not, is a real question for the smooth functioning of our infrastructure. But certainly some of the technology we could use and we will use in our infrastructure are more related for the moment to machine learning and to, well, potentially artificial intelligence, which would help us to be stronger in terms of detection and therefore prevention of risk, where we need here to use all what is possible with the new technologies, fintech. Also, this morning I was in a panel discussing on EID and the fact that identity, digital identity, has to be protected and that appropriate technology has to be used in this field. Here also, I think that the use of fintech technologies which are being there could help us to be stronger. And so in this field, I would say we have probably a lot to learn there and to bring in our platforms and services this. So it will not be using this technology as a core function of TIPS or T2S or the various services we develop with a new generation of services, but probably some of it will come to reinforce again the objective we have is to deliver a safe, well-functioning and efficient market infrastructure for settlement in central bank money and circulation of liquidity, central bank money, amongst our economies. So it's certainly something, yes, we are looking at.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So Larry, are you coming from US? And US is always the center or the core of the financial innovation. And nowadays, lots of companies, including the data giant company, big tech company like GAFA, will enter partially into the financial services. So fintech may have an impact on the financial market or financial structure. So from your point of view, what would be the impact of fintech or fintech type new entrants to the financial service on the structure of financial system or financial stability? I'd like to ask your views on that.
That's a pretty big question.
No, sorry.
I guess there's sort of like two quick ways I'm thinking one could answer that. One is the very direct way of how those developments interact with the banking system and the financial system and make sure it's, you know, the narrow ways they're planning to use it are both safe and efficient and or consistent with each of their roles in the financial system. I think what you're touching on is more broadly, we see a lot of whether it be stated or unstated objectives of innovative ideas is, I might put this a little simplistically, is you see a lot of people working in technologies and new things we could do and discover, wouldn't it be great if we could sort of plug into the central bank? Mm-hmm. And if we could have an account at a central bank or access to a service that we don't currently have, look at all the great things we could do. And for sure, that's true. But when you get into that moment and you're looking at it, it does require society basically to look at the fundamental role of, you know, central banking, commercial banks, and non-banks. And, you know, all of the financial system is in some sense a man-made artificial construct that we've, through, you know, good times and bad times, we've sort of settled on, you know, through survival of the fittest, this seems to work. And so it's often important, and as Mark is saying, one wants to question and rethink, do we have it right? Who should have access? Who shouldn't? What? And if you go to the next stage, whose access should be supported by the public safety net, be it through supervision or liquidity support or, you know, whatever the elements are that give us some comfort in the current financial system, should we change that? Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to face those fundamental issues head on, mm-hmm. rather than sort of ignore it through the back door of just technology. Mm-hmm. And so, so we wrestle with that a lot, and we've been thinking domestically and internationally about those very topics. And as just to connect it to an example I said before, mm-hmm. when the Fed provided this new joint account mm-hmm. approach, that was a way to sort of strike a balance mm-hmm. in sort of maintaining the current understood and agreed structure of the financial system, where there's a set of entities who are allowed to have claims on the central bank, but provided in a way through the designation of an agent by those owners to support both banks and non-banks in having a more innovative way to create and deliver retail payments. So we're looking at it all the time. How can we do it? But it's an ongoing challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. So then I'd like to ask a question from the floor. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and clarify your name and organization, please.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Manoj Agrawal. I'm from India. I'm the group editor for a magazine called Banking Frontiers. In India, we have a particular challenge with all this technology that we talk about. There is a rural segment, there is an underbanked segment which does not have access to a lot of technologies. And that population is huge. So are we looking at technologies that can include a lot of those people? Because historically, that's what technology has done. It has reduced cost, made things efficient, so that the common man can access something, whether it's a phone or a train or whatever. Mm-hmm. Are there low-cost technology solutions that have been examined?
Mm-hmm. Any answer from your side?
I'm willing to jump in. I could start by kicking off the Committee on Payment and Market Infrastructures working with the World Bank had actually taken a look at this topic a couple of years ago, and we've issued a report. It's not very well talked about outside of the narrow community, but it's the payment aspects of financial inclusion. And when we looked at that, we were asking ourselves that very same question, can technology be the solution? We very quickly came to understand that technology can be part of the solution, but looking at technology in and of itself can also aggravate problems. What we discovered is we think it's very important when you're looking at technological innovations to help financial inclusion, basically to keep your eye on the money. Where would the funds that those who are currently in, say, the unbanked who are working in a cash society, if they give up their cash and put it somewhere, where will it be? Will it be in someplace safe? And so it's equally important as we're looking at delivery mechanisms, like say the technology somebody could use, whether it be an iPhone or some other form of access. Where is their wealth going to be? What will be their store of value? And in particular, will it be something as sound as cash, meaning a claim on the government, or might it be a claim on a functional equivalent of a claim on an unsupervised entity, where it creates credit risk for those who are most vulnerable? So it is important to look at where the money is, and one of the core parts of this a strategy for promoting financial inclusion is to ensure that those who are currently unbanked have access to a safe account, a safe place where their money can be stored, and then you can talk about the technology to use it and to deliver it in a way that's meaningful and cost-effective and deals with the social needs of those who are currently unbanked.
Mm-hmm. Any other views from?
Maybe just on the cost element, the last point. I mean, I fully agree with all the points of Larry. I mean, we are working also on this financial inclusion. Mm-hmm. But on the cost of technology, we see that the implication of those new technologies allow us to go to very, very, very low level of cost. Huh? So I think it's the new services which are coming up, thanks to the new technologies and to the smartphones which are getting everywhere, does not need the same infrastructural cost that we needed before to set up those payment systems with dedicated line, with dedicated network, very complex. You have lighter technology which is available, which allow in particular for new entrants or country maybe which have less sophisticated market real infrastructure, sorry, in place to have already services that at a relatively cheap price. I mean, we see that the cost recovery for the TIPS project we are doing allow us to have a fee of 0 to 2 cents per payment. Yes, so we can do 5 payments with 1 cent of a euro. And that allows us to recover our cost. So you can come to level without the transport. I'm speaking of our cost as a system. So you can go really to very low level of cost, provided you have this access. So you need to resolve the first point, indeed. Where can you safely store these electronic records of your wealth? But then once you have it, I think there is ways to do that which are quite efficient, yes.
Greg, do you have anything to add?
No. Can I add a follow-on point?
Please.
So the security costs of IT are going up. Has that been included?
Yes.
In the cost calculations?
So any other question from the floor? Please. So no, please.
Just wondering if in very remote areas, cryptocurrency could almost, you know, if there's no traditional payments infrastructure, could cryptocurrency almost replace fiat currencies?
So please.
Well, why don't you try?
No.
Maybe I can take it and then part of the answer. First, there is no cryptocurrency. It does not exist. There is only crypto asset. So far, I am not aware of what I would call a crypto money. So we are discussing within the central bank community. I guess there is publication on that, on the opportunity or not to issue in a crypto way our currencies. Then you could call this eventually cryptocurrency, I guess. So crypto euro, let's say. And the analysis we have so far on that has been that there is no appetite. I speak for euro. It is the official word of my president, Mario Draghi, for our society to go there because we have efficient functioning cash processes. There is trust in our banknotes and coins, and there is also trust and efficient processes of payment in an electronic manner. As I was saying, we are introducing instant payment, TIPS, but there is also a whole functioning of the payment infrastructure, which is very safe and well functioning. So there is no appetite to go there today and no need to go there today. If the society were to say we need something else, then this will have to be analyzed and considered and to see where to go. But we should be careful here to make difference between technology, between assets or things or some things which is cryptonized or tokenized, and the replacement of currency, which have a economic function, which is very important for the functioning of our economy, which have trust, which have a lot of elements, which are not just exchanging some sync electronically between us.
I would be very glad to elaborate, agree and elaborate on what Mark said. Is it's important to separate, you know, when you're thinking of the kind of examples you're talking about, remote access and different challenging areas of the world, the technologies to reach people wherever they may be, that's separate and is extremely important to think through. That's separate from what is the asset or the crypto asset that is being used in that process. And, you know, in looking at both central bank digital currency and private digital currency or digital assets, the central banks have been looking at that for quite a number of years. And it was just, I think, last year, there was a joint committee report that came out and was very clear that while the technology is very promising and it can be used in different use cases, it was a very clear view that those kind of crypto assets that basically have no inherent value, do not represent a claim on or a liability of any entity, is really unsafe to rely on as money. They're unsafe as a store value, as a unit of account, or a means of exchange. And that was, I think that's a pretty clear and shared conclusion around the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Anything to add?
Yeah, I guess the only, I mean, like has been said already, I mean, for Australia, we don't see a strong use case for the issuance of a digital currency. I think if you're talking about a less developed country with a large unbanked population, in principle, as Larry said, depending on where, if you know where that money is, if it's a claim on a central bank, if it's deliverable via technology that's available, perhaps you could come up with a scenario where that might actually add some value. And even currency itself in some of those remote areas, you can have challenges like counterfeiting, for example. So it's possible, but I think you have to tread carefully because you need to make sure that those people are not exposed to risks that are not apparent to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. 2 weeks ago, Financial Stability Board published a report on crypto asset. In my understanding, main message is that it is very unlikely that the current crypto asset will be used for the daily payment purposes. It's mainly for the speculative investment tools. There's two reasons. First reason is that the price fluctuation is so big, no one wants to use the instrument which value would go up, and no one wants to accept the instrument which value would go down. And the second and fundamental reason is that the trust is the most important thing for the payment instrument. And in terms of crypto asset, the current crypto asset, they need to create a trust from scratch. So they consume a bunch of electricity for the calculation. So this is my understanding of the current report. Please. Okay. The gentleman in the front, please.
Up to now, we have technology that when we get access to Bitcoin or something else, we have also access to tips and things like this. So we don't need these micropayments, what we have discussed 10 years ago for some areas in Africa and so on, that we say, okay, we need micropayments because we have not the access to the real economy. It's now over. So I think it's much more better to look in future that the technology will grow up in this area and we have the way back to the secure coins of the central banks. I think also when we take this new technology and these apps and this PSD2 and so on, the banks themselves has more chances to came back as a home bank directly with a home account. We don't need so much PSBs and PayPals between because we have access directly to the secure money. And so I think with this, things like PSD and so on, we came back to the secure area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe back from?
It's not really a question, I guess, but
yeah. And gentleman behind, so please.
There is a case of use for cryptocurrencies, for example, in Venezuela, when there is a high inflation. So I think it's wrong to assume that we don't need cryptocurrency as a currency. There might be a chance to use cryptocurrency where there's high inflation. And on top of this, I would like to ask if the European Central Bank is thinking to use, it's not an optimal currency area. So is there a chance to use a digital currency in Europe to eliminate the friction of the European area? I don't know if the question is clear.
Well, first, just to qualify, my statement was for Europe. I don't speak for the rest of the world. I cannot judge the situation in different countries, which can be different. For Europe, we have assessed, we are studying together with all central banks. As it was said, there is reports which have been made by the CPMI. There have been reports which have been made by different groups, I think the FSB as well, on reflecting on those developments. So there is a reflection and we are looking at it. We do not believe in Europe today, ECB, that having crypto euro, to take your language, would bring any benefit compared to what we have today. So that's exactly, I think it was repeated very clearly by, again, Mario Draghi like 3-4 weeks ago. I don't know, I was on holiday 2 weeks, so I don't remember. But it's very clear. And it's not, it's a reasoned and I would say point and objective, which is very clear, because we have efficient functioning of our cash society, and because we have efficient and safe functioning of our electronic payment system, which is already delivering a form of digital euro, if you want, through the banking system. We do not believe that we have to get out of the banking system to circulate euro other than with banknotes today in Europe. That's where we are today. When I speak Europe, I speak euro area, to be very clear, because we know there is some reflection in some countries. Sweden is making some reflection on whether a Swedish krona should be issued in an e-krona scheme or not. They have not decided, to my knowledge, to go there, but they are thinking about it. So there is different context in different countries. But for the euro in Europe, we don't believe that it would give any value to us today. Mm-hmm. And the fragmentation is not due to the form of the money, if you want, in this regard.
Mm. Yeah, thank you very much. Very unfortunately, time is running out. Sorry for that. And thank you very much for everyone. Please give a big hands to all the panelists, please.
Thank you. Thank you.